Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is September the 16th, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Many businesses, workplaces, and schools have shut down in March due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We're now into the last half of September, and that means a lot of Americans have shifted to telecommuting and homeschooling, and that puts a heavy strain on internet bandwidth. At Whistleout, they wanted to see how that affected internet speeds across the country. You probably expected internet speeds to slow down with the extra strain, but the average internet speed in the United States actually increased after the pandemic started, and it jumped from 84.9 megabits per second to 94.6 megabits per second. Reason for this is many people have opted for the higher speed. This could be due to consumers upgrading their internet and testing their new connection, or because some internet service providers increased overall internet speeds in response to the pandemic. The states with the biggest increases in internet speeds were Wyoming, with an increase in speed of 52%, Alaska, with an increase of 40% in speed, and Kentucky, with a 37% increase in internet speed. There were states with drops in internet speed, and they were West Virginia, down 13%, Hawaii, speed was lower by 8%, and Delaware, also by 8%. Whistleout looked at over 717,000 internet speed tests, comparing the average results per state from the period prior to the COVID-19 U.S. outbreak to the period after the pandemic started, and they excluded cellular data speed tests, focusing only on home broadband internet connections. Will this increase in overall internet speed usage continue after the end of the pandemic? Probably. Well, this lockdown since March is almost 6 months. A new study out is that the latest to show that the COVID-19 pandemic is taking a heavy toll on Americans' mental health. The research found that more than a quarter of adults surveyed have clearly experienced depression symptoms recently, over three times as many who said the same in a survey taken before the pandemic. Researchers from Boston University and elsewhere recruited more than 1,400 people between late March and mid-April, interviewing them over the phone. These volunteers, intended to be a nationally representative sample, answered a questionnaire routinely used to screen for depression symptoms. Then their responses were compared to a sample of people who had taken part in 2017-18 version of National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, a yearly annual survey of Americans' lifestyle and dieting habits conducted by the government. The same questionnaire was used in both surveys. More women reported depression symptoms than men. During the pandemic, 33% of women had symptoms of depression during the pandemic, compared to only 22% of men. When they included people with mild depression symptoms, this disparity grew larger. Slightly over half of the Americans, that's 52.5%, reported some symptoms of depression during the pandemic compared to 24.7% before. These findings were published in JAMA, that's the Journal of American Medical Association Network Open. Having symptoms of depression doesn't necessarily translate to having clinical or major depression, which can be very difficult to treat and last for months or years at a time. It's possible that many people experiencing symptoms during March and April have already recovered and will do so without the need for dedicated treatment. The number of daily deaths reached their current peak in March and April. This isn't the first evidence to suggest that the direct and indirect effects of the pandemic, such as the death or illness of loved ones over the loss of employment due to lockdowns and scant government support, are affecting our collective mental health in the United States and elsewhere. Indeed, according to the researchers, there's evidence a pandemic may be having a greater impact on mental health than other large-scale traumatic events. During the pandemic, these mental health effects are likely to hit vulnerable segments of the population much harder than others. In the study, people with lower income were at greater risk for depression symptoms than those with high income, while having less than $5,000 in savings was linked to a 50% higher risk of depression symptoms. Lacrosse is a sport, but Google has a project called Lacrosse, spelled L-A-C-R-O-S. The product lifecycle support for a Chromebook is 8 years. The catch is, it is 8 years from date of manufacture. You have no idea when it was manufactured, as it could have been sitting on the dealer's shelf for a while. With a Chromebook, the shelf life is subtracted from the product life support. It's almost like buy the product to find out how long it is supported. The system is probably still useful, but it will no longer get updates, leaving your device vulnerable to security exploits while missing out on cool new Chrome features. And in this case, I'm talking about Chrome the browser, not Chrome the operating system. Google has a project known internally as Lacrosse. Your update woes may soon be a thing of the past. Google's history on device updates have been a significant problem on Android. Back in October of 2017, Android's distribution rate was very disappointing. An embarrassing 0.2 of 1% of devices were running the latest version of the operating system. While Android fragmentation still plagues many devices today, thanks to OEM complacency, Google's Project Trouble is making a substantial difference in increasing the Android adoption rate and further extending the lifespan to older devices. Google now wants to do the same thing for Chromebooks. And the answer is Lacrosse. What is Lacrosse? Lacrosse is an experimental initiative to separate the Chrome browser from the Chrome operating system. This allows Google to ship two separate binaries independently despite its version discrepancy. For example, Chrome OS can be running on OS 87, but the Chrome browser binary can be on version 89. The intent is the continuous support of Chrome the browser on the system even when Chrome OS is no longer supported. This is significant. Currently, Chrome is intertwined deeply with Chrome OS, meaning Google has to compile and ship one monolithic package to the update channels. While that isn't an issue in itself, the major problem lies when a Chromebook hits end of life. Just like on the Android phone, when your Chromebook hits end of life, you lose out on the Chrome OS updates. Losing out on a Chrome OS update also means that Chrome, the browser itself, won't get updated either, which leaves the browser outdated, vulnerable, and unable to take advantage of updated platforms on the web. If you think about this, this could have a huge positive impact in the educational space. Schools are buying huge numbers of older Chromebooks for students to use, especially now with many classes going virtual during the global pandemic. Thanks to Lacrosse, school Chromebooks that hit end of life could continue to receive Chrome updates so students can continue using their web-based platforms. Institutions will no longer have to buy another set of newer, updated Chromebooks, potentially saving a huge amount of money for education. It's unclear exactly what path Google will take with Lacrosse, however. For example, there is no information on how Lacrosse will deploy on Chrome OS once they roll out this feature. Google's trying to further extend the lifespan of Chromebook. Well, what's the apprehension? LaCrosse is, as I stated, is an experimental initiative by Google. Hey, Google, make a commitment. Dozens of Amazon's own products have been reported as dangerous, melting, exploding, or even bursting into flames. Many are still on the market. CNN reported that a fire originated at a home with an Amazon Basics USB cord. It was traced to a white USB cord. Part of the cord was hanging off the chair and still intact, but the other side was stuck to the seat and had melted into a bare wire. It was concluded that the fire originated with the cord being used to charge a cell phone. The report stated the cord experienced a short circuit. The heat produced by the cord ignited the upholstery for the office chair. The cord had been branded with the name Amazon. It was sold by one of Amazon's popular private label lines, Amazon Basics, which offers budget-friendly products including consumer electronics, household appliances, home goods, and office accessories. Launched in 2009, Amazon Basics has grown to offer more than 5,000 products, according to the retailer. Its mission, identifying everyday items that Amazon can create at a similar or higher quality at lower price point when compared to existing name brands, a strategy also employed by companies such as Costco and Target. Using keywords including fire, dangerous, and burn, CNN reporters identified more than 1,500 reviews about Amazon Basic electronics and appliances posted by U.S. customers on Amazon.com from 2016 through early 2020 that described safety-related issues. More than 10% of the reviews identified by CNN reported that products had caught fire, in some cases describing how flames shot out of the devices. Nearly 200 included reports of damage to homes or belongings, including charred walls and fried cell phones. A growing number of Amazon Basics products, which the company promotes heavily on its site, have become bestsellers since the line's inception, and many have ratings above 4 stars, according to Marketplace Pulse Research. In recent months, the online retail sales have been soaring as millions of Americans have been staying at home, and, in many cases, working remotely during the ongoing pandemic. Since 2016, at least 1,500 reviews covering more than 70 items have described products exploding, catching on fire, smoking, melting, causing electrical malfunctions, or otherwise posing risk, according to the analysis of Amazon Basics, electronic and appliances listed on its website. The reviews identified represent a small fraction of the overall purchases of products, and fires caused by consumer electronics are not unique to Amazon-branded items. User error can also be a factor, as can faulty or aging wiring within a home or defective device being used in conjunction with the product. But when well-made and used properly by consumers, electronics like those sold under the Amazon Basics name should really pose dangers. Within the more than 1,500 reviews, many consumers explicitly called out items as potentially dangerous, using terms such as hazard or fire, or saying the product should be recalled. Around 30 items with 3 or more reviews like this remain for sale on Amazon.com today. At least 11 other products that fit this criteria were no longer for sale at the time of publication. Amazon confirmed at least 8 of these products had been under investigation, but said the company determined they all met its safety standards. Customers trusted that Amazon Basic purchases would be safe and well-made since they were branded with Amazon's name and frequently touted as Amazon's choice. But even as complaints have mounted, the company has provided little or no information to consumers or the public about how it is handling allegations that some of its merchandise is unsafe. Many customers said they immediately throw out the defective devices or sent them back to Amazon at the company's request. The retailer said safety is a top priority at the company and it takes a number of steps to ensure all Amazon Basic products are safe and high quality, such as selecting experienced manufacturers, monitoring customer feedback, and testing items to ensure they pass safety and compliance standards both before and after they are available. It also said Amazon Basics offer thousands of products which combined have more than 1 million reviews, and that concerns are thoroughly investigated and that the company acts accordingly. The outcome of the investigation varies on a case-by-case basis and may include removing the product from the store, adjusting the design of the product, notifying the customer to stop using the product, or other appropriate action. A company spokesperson said they want customers to shop with confidence, and if ever a customer has a concern, they can contact customer service and they will investigate. Amazon has already been under intense scrutiny for allowing third-party sellers with allegedly dangerous offerings to do business on the site, and multiple court rulings have ruled that the retailer can be held liable for defect items sold in its third-party marketplace. Amazon said customer reviews are only one indication of a potential issue, saying it looks at a number of other factors such as sales history, returns, and customer service contacts when assessing potential problems. Amazon said using customer reviews alone to conclude a product is unsafe or imply there's a widespread issue is misleading. Businesses are required by law to immediately report potentially hazardous items to the Federal Consumer Product Safety Commission, that's a CPSC, so that the agency can determine whether an official recall is necessary. Companies can also initiate voluntary recalls in cooperation with the CPSC. Concerns similar to those detailed in Amazon reviews have been relayed to the CPSC in at least 10 reports that specifically mention an Amazon Basics product. The complaints cover at least 8 different items and date back to 2012. In the United States, Amazon publicly recalled 2 Amazon Basic items in 2018 and 2019 after the company received 50 reports in the United States about power banks overheating and 25 about versions of a space heater overheating, burning, or sparking. It said it proactively notified the CPSC of the results of the company's own investigation and its intent to recall the items. Beyond these 2 official recalls, the company has never publicly acknowledged that Amazon Basic products have any safety issues. While fires caused by USB cords are uncommon, who said a range of factors could be at play in situations like this, from problems with whatever device the cord is plugged into to defects within the cord itself. As industry nonprofit, the USB Implementers Forum, Inc., said it does not believe user error is a significant cause in the overheating of USB cables. A cable that is substandard, whether because of design or manufacturer defect, can be dangerous and lead to electric shock, overheating, sparks, or fire. The group has certified a number of Amazon Basic cables as meeting their standards, though it focuses on the functionality of the cables and making sure the specifications are in compliance, emphasizing that it is not a replacement for industry best practices or any applicable local, state, or government statutes, rules, or regulations pertaining to safety. The group also said it conducted an internal review of several cables CNN brought to its attention and found them to be compliant. It does not certify proprietary lightning USB cords used for Apple devices. Apple said it allows manufacturers to use its lightning connectors in their products if those items are tested and confirmed to meet high quality standards, and the company expects manufacturers to meet any applicable safety standards. Amazon said if they determine a product is unsafe, they remove it from their stores and take all necessary actions, which may include contacting regulators and customers. 3 former Amazon employees said the vast majority of Amazon Basics electronics are made in Asia. The company lists of supplies used for its various private label lines, including Amazon Basics, shows that only 10% are in the United States and nearly half are located in China. Amazon typically brings Amazon Basics to market in 2 ways. It either goes straight to manufacturers that are able to meet the standard and works closely with them to create items for the Amazon Basics line, or Amazon finds an existing product and works with a third-party company which may use an outside manufacturer of its own to brand the item with the Amazon Basics name. More than 90% of the reviews CNN analyzed were about verified purchases. Reviews were excluded if a product had clearly been used incorrectly. What is a cable card? Cable card is a special-use PC card device that allows consumers in the United States to view and record digital cable television channels on digital video recorders, personal computers, and television sets on equipment such as set-top box not provided by a cable television company. The card is usually provided by the local cable operator, typically for a nominal monthly fee. In a broader context, cable card refers to a set of technologies created by the United States cable television industry to allow devices from non-cable companies to access content on the cable networks. Some technologies not only refer to the physical card, but also to the device that uses the card. Some cable card technologies can be used with devices that have no physical cable card. The cable card was the outcome of a U.S. federal government objective directed in the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to provide a robust competitive retail market for set-top boxes so consumers did not have to use proprietary equipment from the cable operators. It was believed that this would provide consumers with more choices and lower costs. The cable box competition rules have been completely dismantled, however. Last Friday, the Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, in a unanimous decision, eliminated all rules requiring cable providers to support the cable card devices, which are used today in third-party DVRs such as TiVo. It also officially terminated a 4-year-old proposal that would have opened the door to even more cable box competition. Providing cable customers with more hardware choice was the original goal of the cable card, a government-mandated solution that let users securely access cable programming on third-party hardware. Until last week, the FCC required cable companies to lease cable cards that consumers could install themselves and without any price discrimination that would render them cost-prohibitive. Cable companies also had to report to the FCC on their deployments of cable card to ensure they were following the rules. Satellite TV service providers, meanwhile, were never held to similar rules. The FCC now says these rules are no longer necessary, in part because people can just use streaming devices to access pay TV content instead. Well, why cable box competition still matters? There's just one problem with that argument. Streaming apps aren't nearly as prevalent as the FCC claims. Sure, if you are a Comcast subscriber, you can use the Xfinity Stream app in place of a cable box, but that app isn't available on all streaming platforms. Likewise, if you're getting TV service through Spectrum, you can use the Spectrum app, but that app isn't available on all streaming platforms. And if you're a customer of Verizon Fios, you're instead limited to streaming on phones, tablets, and computers. The industry has failed to provide true cable box alternatives on all major streaming platforms. FCC quotes the industry trade group NCTA as saying its mission is accomplished. Heck, I disagree with that. Because the 9 largest TV providers support apps that can be used to watch their content consumer-owned devices. While that might be technically true, it distorts the reality that streaming device support is inconsistent across the board. And although live TV streaming services such as YouTube TV and Hulu Plus Live TV do provide alternatives to cable and satellite TV, their channel lineups are different, and they require fast and reliable internet service, which is not available to everyone. Meanwhile, widespread enforcement of data caps can limit how much video cord cutting can stream over the internet without paying steep overage fees. The FCC has declined to do anything about data caps. Neither the TV industry nor the current FCC has served the interests of the public. Well, that's my 2 cents. presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Miscellaneous Network Definitions.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. I'm going to spend a little bit of time decoding the technobabble. And it's not really technobabble. If we watch Star Trek, sometimes that is technobabble. Actually, most of the time it's technobabble. I replaced the dilithium crystals utilizing the P-spanner on the XY... whatever it is. I don't know. I don't really do the real technobabble well, but I do understand a lot of the jargon that is in the world of the IT professional on the network. So I'm going to give you some words here, and I'm going to give you some definition behind them. Now, mind you, any one of these that I'm going to talk about could actually be, we could take an entire course with the multiple references to just any one of these words, but I'm going to give you some overview. For instance, one of these is domain. Now, the domain is the grouping of computers, and this is, there's usually just one domain within a company. Sometimes we have subdomains, and sometimes we have multiple domains, but it, for the most part, it is a large grouping of computers that are put together. They're administrated and they're communicating with a set of common rules and a set of common procedures amongst them. Usually, there's just a few people in charge of the entire domain that have access across the entire domain. And those are the administrators, the domain administrators. The larger the company that you get, though, the more that each of the positions for those administrators gets narrowed down. So a domain administrator actually may just be one person or a few people who just happen to have access across everything, and they specialize in one of the different areas, which I'm going to be talking about a little bit later. A switch or a router. This is, sometimes we think of this as a hub. We think of this as, we can easily think of this as our broadband router. And sometimes it's just our cable modem or our fiber modem or whatever it is that you've got coming into your home. That modem has a bunch of different ports on it. Well, it's a router or a switch. The switch is kind of the dumber, more simpler version of the router. It just moves traffic around, and it will do some minor regulation of traffic. Now, a router, though, can actually manage some of the functions. It serves as a firewall to protect computers, and there's a number of other different pieces that fit into the entire section of a router. A router or a switch can usually be accessed via remote by the IT professional. They can do some troubleshooting here and there. And that's one of the ways that we move the packets across the network. A packet? What's a packet? So a packet is a collection of data, and it's usually just a general set size. We think of, I connect my computer to the network, and it just talks. Everything on the network, though, has to take turns. If we were into a, if we were put into a room that had 100 people in it, and 100 people all started talking to us individually, one person, they started, 100 people talking to me, I wouldn't understand it. Now, if I go through and each person takes a turn and they give me their little bit of information. Hi, my name is Susie and I'm a doctor. Hi, my name is Jack and I'm a physical therapist. Hi, my name is John and I work on cars. Well, we can get those bits and pieces of information. And that is actually how it happens across a network. It all comes one at a time across that entire network. Via packets, those little bite-sized pieces of information, those bite-sized conversation points along the way. Now, we do that in packets to allow everybody a chance to go through. So I can find out, okay, this is Susie, this is Jack, this is John, this is Nancy, this is Marco. And I can get their names first, and then I can get their titles first after that. And then I can go through and I find out their specialty after that in very small bite-sized pieces or packets of information. And I can accumulate all of that. instead of it being a 5-minute conversation with Susie about everything in her life. So we separate it into packets. Now, those packets go via IP addresses to our computers. You may have heard of this, the Internet Protocol Address, IPv4, IPv6. All it is it says, that's Benjamin's computer, that's Susie's computer, that's Marco's computer, that's Marty's computer. Whoever it is, it puts it all together, and it keeps track of this entire network, and it says, okay, I want to send something just to Marty, and it sends it to his IP address. It's all done through the domain name service by assigning addresses utilizing a DHCP server, which is just a DHCP server is a server that just sits there and hands out IP addresses, kind of like the post office. It says your address is, 123 North Main Street. Nice and generic. Why don't we go with that? And your address over there, yours is 125 South Main Street. And it just assigns those out, that DHCP server or service. And it will all vary within different companies. And all of this kind of stretches back and forth in a number of different directions. And all of this just happens to work. It's all been set up. It's all been written down years ago. It was designed to work. And if it didn't work, well, they fixed it up some more. I hope this gives you a little bit of an idea, a glimpse into some of the terminology we use as IT professionals. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Bluetooth's latest security issue has no timeline for security solution. According to the researchers, the protocols that both Android and iOS follow when linking up to another Bluetooth-powered device, like, say, a pair of speakers, can be hijacked to give an attacker access to any Bluetooth-powered app or service on the phone. This latest threat facing those of us with Bluetooth-enabled devices has no patch in sight. The issue is with a protocol called cross-transport key derivation, or CTKD for short. When an iPhone is getting ready to pair up with Bluetooth-powered device, the protocol's role is to set up two separate authentication keys for that phone, one for a Bluetooth low-energy device and one for a device using what's known as the basic rate enhanced data rate standard. Different devices require different amounts of data and battery power. If a phone supports both of those standards but doesn't require some sort of authentication or permission on the user's part, it can be hacked by a bad actor if it is within Bluetooth range. The Bluetooth special interest team began notifying device vendors about the threat of these sorts of attacks. Bluetooth's corporate statement says that the only way to protect yourself is to keep an eye on the environment where you are pairing your devices together, since any bad actor would need to be somewhat nearby in order to carry out the attack. With no publicized patching timeline from any of these players, we're really being left at the whims of those Bluetooth-powered device vendors and OS operators to do the right thing, and hopefully they'll do it quickly. On the past couple of shows, I've been reporting and commenting on H-1B worker visas. Big banks and big tech firms have been big users of H-1B visas, which have enabled them to hire in global talent that were temporarily banned by President Trump in June of 2020. Despite protestations that the ban would lead to pay inflation for the finite pool of super smart folks that have U.S. citizenship, the ban also have plenty of supporters. Key among them is Hal Saltzman, a professor of planning and public policy at Rutgers University. Saltzman says there's absolutely no reason why banks and tech firms should complain about the lack of H-1B visa talent. Annual hiring demand for top talent position is probably, say, 5,000 new hires a year. Make it 10,000, he says. If you like, he points out that U.S. produces 1.9 million bachelor graduates a year, plus hundreds of thousands of master graduates, plus PhDs, and Sourcepan says it seems implausible they can't find that number among the 1.9 million. Sourcepan pointed out that only a third of all U.S. STEM degree holders are actually employed in STEM jobs, suggesting the majority are underemployed and that the supply of U.S. STEM graduates more than meets the country's demand. The same paper pointed out that the supply of U.S. STEM students is highly elastic and increasing. The U.S. education system has produced ample supplies of students to respond to STEM labor demand. Why then do banks and tech firms like to hire in developers, quantitative analysis, and data specialists from overseas? It's all about labor arbitrage, and that the United States government shouldn't be supporting this. H-1B is the government reaching its hands into the pockets of tech workers, and those are lucky enough to get jobs. If banks and technology firms really need specialist talent from overseas following the H-1B ban, they can still hire them using things like the O-1 visa for outstanding talent, which has fewer constraints than the H-1B. They could also recruit from some of the PhD students who leave U.S. university each year, of which only half are in career jobs. Are we to believe the talent that these companies are looking for is so extraordinary, rare, and greater than doctoral scientists or engineers? As reported by the United States Department of Labor, the majority of H-1B visas that today total over 2,311,000 workers do not have advanced degrees. According to an Economic Policy Institute's comprehensive study concerned with the supply and demand of STEM graduates, findings indicate that for every two students graduating with STEM degrees from U.S. colleges, only one is hired in a STEM job. That's quite a disconnect, especially if training is rigorous. The study was prepared by experts Hal Saltzman from Rutgers, B. Lindsay Lowell from Georgetown, and Daniel Kuhn from Urban Institute and Economic Policy Research, and they concluded that in computer and information science and in engineering, U.S. college graduates 50% more students than are hired into those fields each year. It also concluded that there isn't a shortage of talent, and if there was, wages would have risen rather than remaining flat over the period in question. Looking at the future, the report indicates that there will be three new higher tech degree holders for every two high-tech jobs over the next decade. There are already millions of unemployed college grads. Why is it relatively easy for STEM-trained immigrants to get their green cards compared with non-STEM workers? Does labor really need these master's and PhD-laden workers when most jobs today only require a bachelor's degree? Data provided by the National Science Degree Foundation for STEM degrees awarded, the Department of Education and the Department of Labor Statistics indicate that from 2010 to 2020, there will be 2.5 million STEM-based job openings. Projected STEM degrees earned to fill those jobs in the United States are 3.9 million, with the largest segment, 2.6 million, graduating with bachelor's degrees. Why then do we have a shortage of talent? Is the training received in U.S. universities of lower quality? The Times Higher Education World University Rankings of 2020 includes almost 1,400 universities across 92 countries, the largest and most diverse university rankings ever to date. In the top 100 universities in the world, 30 were in the United States. In the top 10, 7 were American universities. If we continue to staff U.S. jobs with low-cost H-1B immigrants, isn't this reverse offshoring? What difference does it make that the job themselves are on or come back to the United States if they aren't going to students who are preparing for them domestically? If our students can't compete educationally, strengthen the program, but then hire them. Maybe I'm missing something. If I am, enlighten me. Most of the work done by H-1Bs is not high-level work requiring special talent. It is low-level like software tests. Anybody with an associate degree in computer science and some decent ability could do the work. Plenty of hired H-1Bs do even less sophisticated work that has never actually looked at the underlying hardware and stayed at the high-level language level. We need reform. It's overdue. Presenting Marty Winston with his home automation on stage craftiness.
You know, it takes less than you think to fill a home TV screen. In the early days of television, for example, they might hang a piece of poster board with a sponsor name and logo on it and place the product itself on a tea cart with a drape or a tablecloth. TV news studios are often the size of a single car garage, even today. In April of 2019, we bought a 1979-built house from its original owner. It had a mostly unused and unfinished basement, roughly 30 feet by 50 feet. We added framing and created a front section that's roughly 15 feet by 25 feet. You could call it the Northwest Quarter. The north wall end is my office space. The rest is an open space, a stage, from which it will be easy to create any number of small sets for themed presentations, none of which need be permanent. Yeah, we're talking about construction and some do-it-yourself and some contractors, and in this era, everything takes longer. But that makes it easier to explain the changes that have happened, that are happening, and that will happen, and how they will help this space to be a workable, functional studio and not just a basement with a camera. Several cameras, but you get the idea. And listen, I'm sharing this partly because you may want to think about how you appear on Zoom and Skype calls. It doesn't take a lot of space. It doesn't take a lot of prep. It doesn't take a lot of equipment. It just takes thinking in terms of the picture. Well, back to the stage. Once the framing here got established, the first concerns were electrical. The space, the entire space, only had total half a dozen outlets, and the whole house only had a 24-breaker load center box. Well, that got upgraded to 60 breakers, and a whole house surge protector was added to it. Almost 2,000 feet of electrical wiring, mostly 20-amp Romex cable, well, that went into the ceiling and the walls, mostly in the basement. Part of that was to anticipate where power was most likely to be needed, even if just temporarily. Part of that, to be honest, was on principle. A principle that strongly avoids any use of outlet multipliers. You know, one of those plug-in things, you plug it into two outlets and it turns them into six. But no outlet multipliers and no power strips. Want to avoid those entirely. Well, next up for here, and this is a subject you may find useful. Next up is lighting. The basement started with a couple of fluorescent fixtures and half a dozen bare bulbs on pull strings. It will end with all LED lighting, and almost all of that lighting, certainly all of it in the studio area, will be at a color temperature of 4,000 or 4,100 degrees Kelvin. 4,000 to 4,100, because that color temperature provides good, accurate color rendition. It allows consistent white balance for the cameras. It's an option for a huge variety of off-the-shelf LED fixtures, so it shouldn't limit or handicap your choices. Now, envision the studio area as a rectangle that's longer north to south than it is east to west. The main studio area has three main lights. One of those is a trio of round ceiling fixtures in a line with less than a foot separating them and with no dimming. These are at the south end of the studio, where their most common goal will be product shots. Each delivers a little more illumination than an old 100-watt bulb, and they all have good diffusers, so it's a shadow-free light. You're not going to bury the product in shadows. Using diffusers, using clusters of light sources, and avoiding shadows, those are useful. You might want to try that in your own lighting. And note that something under dead center will get even brightness across it, or there's an option of going to either side to allow a little more contour. Part of that is in the lighting. Part of that is in how you set up your camera. And if you're recording the content these days, part of that can happen in your editing software. Along the long west wall, up near the ceiling, is our wash light, so called because it's long enough and bright enough to wash the entire studio space with light. For things we shoot along the east wall, this is on the west wall, so opposite it, for things we shoot along the east wall, it can provide a front light. Now, this fixture is 8 feet long, but it's only 6 inches wide. In this case, think of wide as meaning tall. And that light is on a dimmer, specifically a 0 to 10 volt dimmer that's part of a three-way switch. In any mix of lighting, that gives us the choice of making it a primary or secondary illumination source, or, of course, turning it off. Now, opposite that fixture, on the ceiling near the east wall, not all the way to it, but near it, is a 4 foot by 2 foot edge lit fixture, flat panel, flat as a pancake. Its long east edge is about a foot and a half from the east wall. It's also on its own dimmer. Depending on how and where we set up a shot, that can be a top light, a front light, or a back light, or, again, turn it off. Those alone are the only fixed lights we need, just those three little setups. That's all we need. But there is one more. One will almost certainly change before we use it in shooting. It's a downward-facing LED ribbon at the ceiling, where the ceiling meets the east wall. Actually, it's kind of behind a long white shield, so all you see is the glow coming down. Now, this offers the potential of adding a bloom of light across the top of the wall. Now, that'll take some trial and error to determine what exactly we can get that to deliver. The idea of it is to kind of have a signature in the shot. Always have that wash at the top of the wall. Always have that wash at high levels on the screen. It's consistency. The office area near the north wall has three thinner edge-lit lights. Not thinner in thickness, but they're each 1 foot wide and 4 feet long, where that big one on the stage is 2x4. These are 3 1x4s. Two of them are at right angles above the two sections of a right-angle desk, and the third is over a credenza table behind me. All three share the same 0 to 10 volt dimming control. Also, these three lights are slightly warmer than the studio lights at 3,500 degrees Kelvin. It's just enough difference in tonality to help set the office shots apart if we ever need to shoot into the office. You know, there are also lighting changes that impact the rest of the basement for various reasons. Motion-triggered lights are at both exit stairways. Circular LED fixtures, flat pancake things that are not much bigger than floodlight heads, well, those are in the storage area. Remember those three lights at the south end of the studio, each about as bright, a little brighter than a standard 100? Well, there's another three, same fixture, so I've got a total of six of those. Another three, spread out slightly wider, are over the test bench in the northeast quarter of the basement. We'll have some shooting to do there, too, as we go into the technical products. Now that the lighting is in and has been tested, and that just happened last week, it's time for us to start adding drywall and paint to one face of each of two of the new framing sections. These are backdrops for our shots. The rafters, exposed right now, those will get covered, not very far down, with white autem. That's AUTEM acoustic ceiling. It's fabric-based, inch-thick ceiling cover. A multiple-layer fabric that reduces noise, and the white color will help diffuse and spread the lighting. The floor will be getting LVT, luxury vinyl tile, in a light gray. You now have a lot of the picture of the physical space, but there's a lot about the audio and video setup that may also interest you. While we could do everything with one camera, we tend to use at least three and as many as half a dozen. Tripods help us crank the cameras up high and shoot downward, so the relatively low height of the 7-foot ceilings aren't noticeable in the shots. One camera can get the presenter, one can get the product shot, and that's a decent two-camera approach. We also have special visualization cameras for time-lapse, for heat imaging, and so on, and an action cam for involving cutaway hands-on product and use shots. Voice over audio can happen with the office mic, the same one behind these radio segments. There's also a wireless mic, a lavalier, and several other available mics for recording not only voice, but also the operational sounds that some products make or that we might make while using products. Also, and this is a good trick, we let the cameras record. When we're editing, we can choose among the best audio-video sources for each shot that we want to lay down and either drop them in or mix them in as is appropriate. Having the audio also on the video means we can sync the action up just by listening to both tracks together. Absolutely, they were spoken at the same time, or whatever noise happened at the same time. All of this, believe it or not, all of this is more sophisticated, more technological, more agile, and higher quality than the gear that was in real TV studios as recently as the 60s or 70s. And all of this makes it possible for just one person to be the entire production crew, and on camera, too. The whole idea, an idea you may want to adopt, is to have a concept ahead of time of what you want to say and what you want to show, and to never be just a talking head. Next time, just to keep it simple, the subject is winter. More specifically, it's about things you can do to prepare for the winter, as well as things you can't prepare for, plus things that especially impact this pandemic era. That segment is called No Wonderland. No wonder.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut Tri-State Region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the computer club. The New York Java SIG is celebrating its 25th anniversary. The New York Java SIG is the first Java user group, and it is the largest in North America. They will be streaming the celebration of their 25th anniversary event on YouTube September the 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The inventor of Java will be one of the panelists at the event. The registration is free. To get more information, you can do a search on NYJAVA SIG, that's New York Java SIG, space 25th space anniversary. I have a more detailed URL, but I'll post it on the website since it's quite detailed. The Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, September the 22nd at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group, What is the Right Way to Repair Movement? Thursday, September the 24th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is pcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on web services, Thursday, October the 1st, 2020, at 7 p.m., via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, October the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. And the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. And their website is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch, and remember, do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.